From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. New Yorker film critic Anthony Lane's currency is the crackling bon mot, his trade the trash and the classics that bookend the movie business. Far from the madding crowd of emphatically raised thumbs and exclamatory blurbs, Lane descends on film like a high-humored literary gadfly, nimble and quick without mercy. And for a guy who wasn't even alive when Casablanca first made Rick's Cafe a cultural landmark, he somehow has the wisdom of years. And so we get a critic who bows before the flawless conceit of Groundhog Day, and we buy it. We get a Robert Redford whose face is crinkled and potato chippy, and we let him get away with it. We get an age of innocence that is Raging Bull in a china shop, and we pretend to know what the heck that means. Or do we? Do you read Anthony Lane? To learn about the movies, or for the sheer joyful wallop? And if you've never read Anthony Lane, does he sound like the kind of critic you'd trust your $8 with on a Saturday night at the movies? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is New Yorker film critic and staff writer Anthony Lane, whose new book, Nobody's Perfect, is a collection of his New Yorker writings. Good evening and welcome, Anthony Lane.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you with us. I know we will have listeners who race to the New Yorker every time it slides under the door or falls out of the mailbox and turn ASAP to see if there's an Anthony Lane review, and we will have others who don't.
Well, yeah, we also have that third category who like turning it to because they're feeling a bit on the dull side this morning. They want something they can really disagree with violently, and they've got some offal in the fridge. They want to put in the post and in the mail and send off to me because you know I always feel people when they're really incensed by movie review and they disagree with it violently. The thought that some of the mail I get, I might as well just get severed heads in the post. But I like to think that movies provoke strong opinions and
you clearly provoke it and like provoking it.
Well, yes. I mean, I always think movie criticism begins, and everybody's a movie critic to the extent that we all go to the movies and then we come out of the movies and go and sit, you know, in a bar or in a cafe and just start arguing. And at that point, movie criticism begins. And I'm actually very empirical about movies. I'm hopeless at constructing long arguments around movies. What I like is, people who start by saying, "I like that bit where." Or, you know,
and you're right into it.
These are a few of my favorite things. You know, because I think movies are just everybody talks about my favorite bit where or my favorite moment in. Do you remember that thing where Robert Redford did this? A critic has to kind of honor that feeling of a sensation overload. You know,
you honor it head on. It's so clear that this is not a vastly mapped out, diagrammed advance on a movie. It's improv. It's guerrilla. Lightning strike and an awful lot of just riffing. When I read your reviews, Anthony Lane, I can almost imagine, you know, the air guitar working in your study in London or wherever you write.
Yeah, well, more just an air spinet in my case, isn't it really?
an air
clavichord. I mean, I think my parents would be very quick to take away any air guitar they found in my bedroom, I'm sure. The business of the judgment that you hand down on a movie, the verdict you deliver, is one of the less important things of your job.
The thumbs up, thumbs down.
Well,
who cares?
I certainly think that anybody who applies for a job with a movie critic should be in their contract. They should go to hospital and just under local anesthetic have their thumbs removed. You know, and it should be fingers only from then on. Maybe toes up would be fine, because you know, I mean, we all do that. I mean, why should my thumb up or thumb down be any, you know, have any more validity than yours? What my job is just to start to, as it were, lay out the landscape of the movie to give you a feeling of what it actually feels like. I mean, I get. You know, New York is very kind. They give me lots of space to riff on these things. So I use that space not merely to condemn or to praise, but actually to give people a feeling of what it's like to sit in that movie theater and see the movie. And I mean in the movie theater. I don't mean sitting watching it on tape. I don't mean sitting around with a bunch of other movie critics. I mean, you know, I don't know if you've ever seen a bunch of movie critics, but it is like, you remember, when you get that five-stage diagram, you're going from like apes to sort of modern Homo sapiens.
Well, yes,
and there's always five sort of figures slowly growing upright. Well, film critics are around number four, okay, or possibly number three even.
from the simian end.
You kind of go in on a Monday morning, we're all just there, you know, knuckles grazing the ground.
I read in your introduction with wonderment your description of how the industry works, how film criticism works, how people are put on buses and or planes and taken off to Atlantic City and wined and dined for that little blurb that will end up on the billboard. Yeah. I loved your description. You say, I once went to a junket and heard the assembled hacks, the critics, complaining to each other about the water pressure in their hotel jacuzzis. I am as corrupt as the next man, but I must admit the notion that you could trim your critical opinions to accord with the fizzy water in which you recently dipped your ass had until then never occurred to me and still strikes me as impractical today.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's just, of course, just professional jealousy, because no one's ever since then, no one has offered me a single, you know, hot tub.
I don't actually believe that. The swag must get deep around your office. Yeah.
Well, in fact, they presume they were either totally corruptible or totally incorruptible, and no one has ever sort of stood there at the entrance of the movie and handed me $20 and said, try me, Kaiser. And if they would, they might get somewhere, but as it is, I'm left to my own independence of thought. But I do wonder, I mean, those guys who do those quotes, you know, I opened the New York Times today, and it had, you know, this huge, great quotes for Four Feathers. I've seen the movie, and, you know, it's a very long movie. It should be trimmed to at least three, at most three feathers, you know. I mean, there's just too much. There's too much feather in it, and some of these. If you read those quotes, you would think that, you know,
God's gift to modern cinema.
You had finally the cinema had moved into a new and greater stage. You know, we had reached the sunlit uplands of the art form. Now, who are these guys? I mean,
and yet we know, don't we? I mean, doesn't every moviegoer know
that
you can
strange?
Find somebody
in
KPDXQE who will say fabulous about anything?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, of course. I mean, they're doing their job. It's just not film criticism. It's something else which will probably go nameless. Even though we know that,
you'll eventually name it. You know, you will, Anthony Lane. I want to beg your indulgence here. I know that you're a reluctant reader of your own work, but in respect of the listeners who may not have read your work, if there are one or two out there who are not weekly readers, it would be great to give a flavor if you'd be good enough. I love the opening paragraph of your review of Pulp Fiction. I'm looking here at your new book, Nobody's Perfect. It's a collection of almost a decade of reviews, and I mean there are a lot of reviews in here, and it's a big book.
It's a big book.
It's a laugh a page. It's a laugh a graph. It's fantastic.
It's an offensive weapon disguised as a book, I think. It's a very thick book. If anybody tries to shoot you, just put this book in the way, and like people with Bibles in wartime, and the bullet will barely make it through to page 50.
Or read it, and you'll see how it's offensive in the very best way. But indulge us. Give us the first paragraph of
this
your
is the first
Pulp
paragraph,
Fiction review.
And this is, as you remember, 1994. This is Pulp Fiction. Everybody knows the old E.M. Forster distinction between story and plot. The king died and then the queen died is a story. The king died and then the queen died of grief is a plot. Fair enough. But what Forster failed to foresee was the emergence of a third category, the Quentin Tarantino plot, which goes something like this. The king died while having sex on the hood of a lime green Corvette, and the queen died of contaminated crack borrowed from the court jester, with whom she was enjoying conversation about the relative merits of Tab and Diet Pepsi, as they sat and surveyed the bleeding remains of the lords and ladies whom she had just blown away with a stolen .45 and a fit of grief. It is hard to know what Forster would have made of Tarantino's new movie Pulp Fiction. I suspect he would have run gibbering into his study, locked the door, and hidden behind the bookshelves. Not just because of the bloodshed, all that brain matter suddenly appearing on the outsides of people's skulls instead of working quietly within, where it belongs, but because of the equal violence done to narrative form.
And this for Pulp Fiction, which we all remember got raves up, down, and sideways in the United States. How do you work up the cheek, Anthony Lane, to sit in London, look out across the Atlantic on the United States of America and the grandeur or gaudy pile of Hollywood and render these judgments?
Are you really suggesting I see these movies before I write about them? I mean, God, good God, man. I mean, you know.
Forster and occasionally looking up.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, pure prejudice has been driving me for years. I mean, occasionally I go to films, but no, I mean, you know. I did once toy with the idea. What would it be like to have reviewed Godzilla without actually seeing it? I mean, it would be as a technical exercise, you know, because I went to the premiere. I'd seen the remake. Yeah, yeah. I mean, there were those endless trailers for months beforehand, mm-hmm. which were really good. I think much better than the original movie.
But you'd essentially seen it.
We had all this. You've seen clips. You've seen trailers. You've read all the pieces. You know, and you could go to the premiere. You could go to the post party, the party after the premiere. Would the piece I would have written then be that different from the piece I'd written when I actually did see the movie? Not that different, I'd say. I've never quite dared do this, and sadly, I do see these movies, but sometimes, and I don't, I never regret having seen the movie. That's the other thing. I think if you said that you you sat down with a sinking heart, you know, as the screen went dark. You shouldn't be in the job, you know. I mean, I do go in, and as the screen goes down, it is still, to me, an exciting thing. And I go in with high hopes. I mean, they're almost invariably dashed. But nevertheless, every day you do think, this new Heath Ledger movie, this could be the one that does it.
So hope springs eternal there, but I want to get you to look at this issue of the guy in the UK writing about US film. Does it matter where you're writing from?
No. I mean, I split my time between London and America. I'm essentially Heathrow man, you know. I mean, I just sort of sit... I sit eating food out of small square plastic trays and things like this.
I've 150 flights in the last 10 years.
I haven't used metal cutlery in years now. You know, and I kind of make sure that ladies remove high heel shoes when they leave my presence.
Do you ask yourself, will Americans understand this turn of phrase?
Is this American friendly humor?
Am I on the wavelength of my readership?
Well, I mean, this is you must blame the New Yorker for this. No, I mean, I'm very keen not to say this movie just isn't cricket, frankly, I mean, most of the writing I love, most of the critical writing I love has been American, and I hope that, it's infused enough to make it clear that the writing is itself a homage to the country that I love and that I'm writing about America. I'm hardly the first Englishman much greater than myself have trodden this path, you know, Raymond Chandler most notably. Raymond Chandler managed to change the nature of American speech whilst being an Englishman. I wouldn't begin to compare myself with him, but it is the case that I think you have to go, you know, pitch your own voice as you want it and trust that it's, you know, going to engage people. And, you know, they always have the option to, you know, fire their rifles at the magazine, but that's never actually been too much of a complaint.
You're a Tina Brown legacy, but it works without Tina Brown at the New
York. There was some terrible clerical error, and I was brought in. You know, as I say in introduction, I can remain convinced there is this. There is another Anthony Lane somewhere, this very distinguished elderly American gentleman who knows all about movies. And he's still waiting for the call 10 years on, and instead of which, by some awful sort of mistake in the office, you know, they call the wrong guy.
and I jumped
at my chance, you know. And indeed, quite interestingly, most of the people at the magazine who read the magazine think that I am 75 years old. And they're not wrong. The book blows my cover because there's this boring straight white young Brit on the back, but I mean, they're obviously happy to think that I'm 75, and I'm happy to maintain that illusion.
My producer said 75 and gay.
Yeah.
I don't know what's the cross-cultural message here, but we're reading along in Speed, the review of Speed, which you, I love the beginning. You say, Speed is set in Los Angeles. Most of it takes place on a bus. It is a film full of explosions, but bare of emotional development. Its characters are no more than sketches. It addresses no social concerns. It is morally inert. It's the movie of the year.
Yeah, well, that's just because it's a ride, isn't it? I love really good action movies, and I'm distressed by how few that really, really work. I feel the same way about comedies. I mean, one of the reasons you mentioned Groundhog Day is if you look back over the last 10 years, I mean, one sees so many comedies that have started off, so promisingly with a lovely conceit and just haven't bothered to work it through. And Groundhog Day was one of the very few that, you know, took the conceit, worked out the logic of it, and brought it to a satisfying conclusion. And the movie is just that interesting stage now where it is becoming a lot of people's favorites and is acquiring classic status.
Throw it in the video machine and sink back into Groundhog Day yourself.
Plus the weirdness of watching a movie again and again, which is about living a day again and again. And the other way in which I mean, there's a lot of book which is about comedy, and I've always flown the flag for comedy, and which is always, you know, we know no comedy's ever win Oscars, all this sort of stuff. It's somehow thought as that nobody's going to move to, no one will give an Oscar Groundhog Day, they'll give it to, you know, Beautiful Mind, which is so much less funny. The reason for this is because comedy takes jabs at our sense of solemnity of us, you know, the solemn way in which we treat ourselves.
So only the solemn can get the golden Oscar.
Well, we want to feel that movies are somehow flattering our sense of ourselves as serious beings. But of course, when only very rarely we're serious beings. And as Chaplin very brilliantly said, tragedy is close up and comedy is long shot. Only very rarely in life, you know, do we get into close-up? You know, do things focus and become genuinely serious? And the camera needs to draw back, bring in other people, and the moment you get other people in it, life turns comic.
Have a laugh. Anthony Lane, we have to take a short break. Please stand by. Listeners, here's your chance. Has Anthony Lane made you choke on your popcorn, made you howl in disagreement? About what? Which film? Witch, Wicked, Barb. What do you want from a movie reviewer? A summary, a judgment, a literary romp? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with New Yorker film critic supreme Anthony Lane. He's out with a new book. It's entitled Nobody's Perfect. It's almost a decade's worth of his reviews of movies and beyond in one great, big, and very funny. I highly recommend it. Book, Nobody's Perfect. What do you think? Here's your chance. Has Anthony Lane made you choke on your popcorn? And what do you want to go after him about tonight? Lane sees Demi Moore and says, "What's the point?" Well, what is the point? He sees Robert Redford and calls him a crinkly potato chip. Do you agree? Pulp Fiction, he says, is vile jelly. Yay or nay? Are you on board with the wild ride of Anthony Lane? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Anthony Lane, you raise the flag for trash in the movies and for classics, but you're very hard on everything in between. Why the valley between the two peaks?
Well, this arose because I read a piece which is in the book about bestsellers. I sat down and I read the 10 books on the New York Times bestseller list in 1994, and I had a great time. Some of it was really terrible. Some of it was good, not just in being enjoyable, but actually it seemed to me to have an energy which is somehow denied to supposedly more serious novels.
1994. Was this
1994? I was doing,
Tuesdays
I read the
with Maury, or I don't remember.
I had to read the Bridges of Madison County, for instance.
Oh,
fortunately, I hadn't eaten beforehand, so I was just dry retching, you know, and there's nothing to come up really. On the other hand, I got to read the Alienist, which is a very, very good historical thriller by Caleb Carr, and I got to read Judith Krantz, you know, and Judith Krantz is, I'm not sure they're really books, but they're so sensational. There's these glittering sort of marketing opportunities, and there's something about the energy of these writers down at the trash end of the market, and also, I mean, some are genuinely good. I mean, I've always said that I think, you know, if you read Emil Leonard and then you go and read a very serious novelist like Iris Murdoch, I mean, there is more going on in terms of, you know, the ear for human speech and the way that we betray ourselves in conversation in Emil Leonard than there is in these major philosophical novelists. And
you're saying hooray for trash, but don't give me the pretense of something more thoughtful?
If I want thoughtful, I want old thoughtful. I want thoughtful that has been passed by the judgment of history and is now agreed to be worth reading. So, I mean, the book has got lots of Shakespeare in it, and it's got quite a lot of Demi Moore in. Now, there's an interesting meeting of minds. Well, one might. And there's most of the authors I write about in the second half of the book, which splits exactly between book, movies and other stuff, are people like Evelyn Waugh and, God, what else is there? There's a piece about sex surveys.
You've got everybody. You've got cookbooks.
If you write the piece I had more come back to than any I've ever written was a piece about cookbooks. And if you write about cookery or sex or any of the things that we talk about and are very bad at doing in our privacy of our own kitchens and bedrooms, you know, you will get a lot of comeback. Everybody has cookbooks and they are the books we read most, and nobody thinks of them as books at all. We think of them slightly annoying friends. Mm. And so I thought, well, that's actually kind of an interesting subject. And I went through them and read, you know, actually sat down and read The Joy of Cooking for the first time, and found plenty to write about. And there's a very good, they brought out these very serious surveys of sexual behavior, which...
We have to have those, and we have to have them regularly.
Yes, exactly. And they should tell you absolutely nothing about sexual behavior, but you just know that the researchers had a terribly exciting time getting all the research together.
Anthony Lane, stand by. We have callers who want to join us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. What do you want from a movie reviewer? A summary, a judgment, a literary romp? And what do you want to hear Anthony Lane riff on right now, tonight? You can join us, 1-800-423-TALK. Walter's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Walter. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I really enjoy Anthony Lane's writing, and I enjoyed his predecessor and still do, David Denby.
Sure.
A lot of times I read these reviews, and I haven't the foggiest notion what they're talking about. And I still find them to be literary essays that kind of reflect the time. And I find them to be very much in the tradition of the New Yorker, where Ross would say, okay, you know, take a piece of paper and make fun of something.
Well, so, Walter, do they help you decide whether or not to go to the movie, or does it matter?
Oh, to me, it doesn't matter because, first of all, I've got small children. If it's not animated, I'm not likely to see it.
Well, yeah, I have small children, so I mean, it does cut into one's viewing pleasure. I find there's, I'm not sure that I would take my 3-year-old to see Scream, not least because he could probably scream louder than anything else in the movie. It should be possible to read a movie review without having seen the movie. I mean, I prefer to think that if people could see the movie, they could come to the review afterwards, you know, and find something to disagree with or agree with. But if it's good enough, it should work pretty well as a self-sustaining essay.
So Walter, do you sit down with it and say, well, I don't get the movie, but I've had Anthony Lane, and wow, that was a trip.
Yeah, no, I probably passed in Heathrow. I spent a lot of time in planes, and so my pleasure of the movie is more likely to be gotten out of the review than out of the than out of popcorn.
Walter, thanks for your call. And here's a vote for the texture you bring to it.
It's very kind of Walter to say so. Sometimes, of course, I feel like if I do sort of take issue with the movie and say, you know, this is really pretty terrible, maybe I've actually saved people $8. You know, maybe they were going to go to the movie and then they didn't. In which case, they owe me $8. You know, and I go through my mail expecting this money to come in. It's just not there. Come on, people. You know, I need that cash.
But it's not just $8. I mean, you're thanking Walter, but in the book, I hear you. I read you asking for something else, not for someone who's enjoying your wonderful kind of literary gymnastics around Hollywood. But you say, I hope in a small back room in a country town where a reader will suddenly jump up and down in an unprecedented fury, enraged by my appraisal of Speed or the Bridges of Madison County, and bang his head on the ceiling. You want opposition, even violent opposition.
Well, I mean, movies seem to provoke this, don't they? They always have done. My great predecessor, Pauline Kael, who I think was even more violently opinionated than I was. I mean, her reviews read like someone who is actually standing there, you know, not hectoring you, but sort of delivering her verdict and being... and really, I think she was genuinely convinced that she was right on movies, and most of the time she was right. And I think she was, I think she was even more fun when she was wrong. And it may be that's another reason why you shouldn't hang out with just movie critics. You should hang out with real people, because I mean, if Mrs. Spielberg has bothered to spend $150 million on a movie, the least we can do, you know, is go and see it in as a movie critic, is go and see it in a proper movie theater, you know, and feel the kind of, you can feel the kind of restlessness or the enthusiasm of an audience. It should be an abstract thing, but it's an extremely tactile thing, you know. You can tell when an audience is, when a movie is losing its audience.
Absolutely.
There's that shifting sort of rustling sound. People are getting up a bit, yeah. But when they're gripped, you know, they're really gripped, and it's genuinely exciting. And, you know, if you... Spielberg, when people at the end of E.T. or Close Encounters stood there on the screen staring up at this light, of course it felt like us sitting there staring up at them. I mean, it was an entirely gripping experience. On the other hand, sometimes I wish I could read movies a bit later, just after they come out. I mean, Forrest Gump is not an interesting film, never was an interesting film.
You say this movie is so insistently heartwarming that it chilled me to the marrow.
Yeah, well, that's because I'm a heart nation. But I think, but the story of the success of that movie is culturally interesting. You know, the fact that it obviously, touched a nerve, you know, across the country is something that, to my shame, I didn't really predict, and I should have seen it. And I would have almost liked to go back and review it like 2 months later, you know, when people were going back to see it again and again and again. But, you know, why should that movie at that time? It in some ways, it felt more like a Reagan-era movie that was coming out at a Clinton period. I'd be interested to know how people look back on that movie, whether they're are they ashamed of their love of it? Do they maintain their devotion to it? One of the things the book is about is how our tastes change. Mm-hmm. I have a long piece about The Sound of Music, for instance, which, mm-hmm. you know, I saw when I was 5 or 6, mm-hmm. you know, and I didn't know whether the movies were good or bad. I just knew it had, like, you know, singing nuns in it. It seemed enough at the time, and children dressed in curtains, you know.
talk to us about that arc of change. How are they changing?
Well, and the fact that I know that movie is more important than any judgment I may have had of it in any period of my life. You know, I went back to it because there was this fantastic thing that they do in London and now in New York and elsewhere, where you have a sing-along of Sound of Music, and it shows.
I've been to one.
Have you been to one?
Isn't what a great evening.
It is the most fun you
people
can have.
People dressed up in their dirndls and mountain boots,
yeah,
yodeling in the theater.
There was a guy dressed up in what appeared, he looked like a parcel, and I said, well, what is that? And the guy said, brown paper packages tied up with string, of course, you know. Someone who'd honestly taken the trouble to cover themselves in brown paper and wrap string around themselves and then walk through the streets to the movie theater. You know, I mean, this is devotion to the art form, is it not? I mean,
I couldn't wait to put on my knickers and hold the guitar and with my daughter in
If you have personal problems, then that is entirely your business. And maybe listeners don't want to know about these things. But, I mean, it is the case that, you know, I don't know about you, but after 30 years, I was word perfect with those songs. What they do is they run subtitles along the bottom and you sing along. And you know, I was like high on a hill with a lonely goat herd. Even the little sounds they make after that, which I won't do on air.
So what are you telling us here? That we've come somewhere from The Sound of Music, or that we just, it becomes the kind of a cosmic bath we want to dive back into?
Well, no, I just think it's in the bloodstream. And then once it's there, all we can do is, you know, it'll go in and out of favor. Of course, but when you're 18, you think you wouldn't be seen dead watching The Sound of Music. But then it'll come back once you have children of your own, for instance. This has a serious point, which is like, what will it be like to watch King Lear, to go to the theatre and watch King Lear when we're old men? You know, it must feel like which is full of these ungrateful children. It'll feel like a very different play.
But when you're just as grey as Lear.
Absolutely. And also, I mean, I suddenly realised a couple of years ago that I was now older than Hamlet, you know. Beforehand, you've always thought, well, you know, Hamlet's, you know, this, you know.
I don't know, the dust jacket picture here, I'm not sure I'd agree, Anthony.
Yeah, no, I'm older than Hamlet. Hamlet is a typical philosophy graduate student. He wears a lot of black, he hangs around reading, he makes a complete pain of himself. And the first time ever, about a couple of years ago, I saw it and I thought, well, you know, that Claudius, he really has a point, you know. I mean, he's trying to run run Denmark. You know, okay, he had to cut some corners, he had to kill the glass guy, but, you know, this is realpolitik, okay?
And he's younger than you. Anthony Lane, hold the phone, stand by. Callers want to come in here. Let's bring them in because they want to talk to you. Amanda's calling from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Hi, Amanda, you're on the air.
Hi. The reason I'm calling is I'm an avid movie watcher. I can't go into a video rental place and find one I haven't seen yet.
Oh, you are avid.
Wow. That's,
yeah, I have a collection of movies that range around 3,000.
Do you have a social life at all?
No, I don't.
Well, it's a very good substitute anyway, I think, you know. Cary Grant is often more fun than most of one's friends.
But I truly enjoy movies. I don't watch TV at all. I don't even have any TV channels I pick up.
Wow.
But I do truly love the movies. However, I rarely agree with critics for some reason. And there's one movie that I've never heard a review on, but everybody I've talked to that has seen it really disliked it except for me, and I thought it was really well done.
You've got Anthony Lane. Try him out.
And I was kind of just curious what your opinion was on the movie.
Drum roll, please. What is it?
The movie is In Dreams. It had Robert Downey Jr.
Wow. Well, I did see that, actually, strange enough, and I will contend anything with Robert Downey Jr. I'm very, very keen on. I mean, I'm not sure if the movie is on Neil Jordan, I think, wasn't it, and Annette Bening, I think.
Yeah.
I think Robert Downey Jr. is an interesting case because he is someone whom the tabloids and the kind of pop press want to treat just as a kind of a case. You know, he's had a terrible private life. He's obviously he's had moments when he's to his by no admission he's been completely out of control. That's all that people really know him for, the drug problem, the kind of handguns. But the fact remains is he's a fantastically gifted actor.
But what's the gist of this film, In Dreams? Amanda's got 3,000 films, and this is at the top of her list.
Yeah, I have to say, I thought she was about to come up with something from, like, 1923. I mean, everybody, my point is, not regardless of this film in particular, everybody has a movie which they sort of hold very dear to themselves and which they sort of jealously guard. You know,
Amanda, what do you like so much about it, Amanda? What is it about this film?
I don't know. It's just something that kind of grabbed out at me. It was done in a very abstract way, but at the same time, it just feels real. Even though it's obviously there are things in there that it's just you got to be really open-minded to believe. But it just had a very good effect. The acting was done very well. I think all the shots that they took in the movie were done.
So it scores for you.
Everybody has to have an In Dreams, and it will be the case that lots of other people won't like it. And everybody has their, you know, somewhere there will be someone who goes, you know, Police Academy 11, that was the one for me. You know, Porky's the Revenge, it has to be.
Something for everyone. Amanda, thank you for calling. Anthony Lane, what about this? Here, you're pouring out your heart in these brilliant essays. They're, I don't know, 2,000, 3,000 words long. But here's the film goer, and a very avid film goer, and her summary is, it just works for me.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, you're not going to be able to make it, you know, that we have no kind of soul-piercing armor with this, do we? And I mean, you're not going to turn people around on it. And at a certain point, people retract into their own opinions. And that, again, is why I say, you know, my business is to describe the film, to entertain, to reflect, perhaps to lead people in other directions. You know, if I was writing about In Dreams, which I kind of obviously don't like as much as Amanda did, indeed, she was like more, she probably likes it more than anybody who even made the thing. Nevertheless, for me, it would be a case of, good, I can talk about Robert Downey Jr., who I think is very interesting, you know, and was kind of great at playing Charlie Chaplin and so forth. And he, you know, he's someone I always look out for. So, you know, even if the movie is, you know, to me is a little bit on the tepid side, I hope I can always find something. I just wrote about Sweet Home Alabama, for instance, which is out next week. Now, I mean,
how do you like it? What do you say?
Well, it's got Reese Witherspoon in it. I love Reese Witherspoon. She's very smart and perky, and she actually reminds me of some. I do think she would be very happy, like many movie stars, if she was, you know, in 1937 and Ben Hecht was writing screenplays for her. You know, because she's got a little round face like, you know, Irene Dunne or Mary Astor. And she's got a very good comeback and everything. And she gets landed in these movies which are just so much slacker than she is. You know, I mean, Legally Blonde is fun, but it's fun because of her, isn't it, really? Uh-huh. And this movie is very slackly directed and written, but she's so smart and perky in the middle of it all that people will go and see it. So in a way, she's quite lucky because she is better than her material, apart from the very good movie she made called Election. But I sort of, you think, God, you know, somebody give this woman the scripts that Carol Lombard had. You know,
But then you turn around and you look at Demi Moore, and your line is just as simple. What is the point of Demi Moore?
This is the beginning of my review of The Scarlet Letter, which was an interesting adaptation of Hawthorne's novel, which came out in 1995. And I think I may have been, I saw it, so I probably constitute about 25% of the total national audience.
you wrote, there is more suspense. Let me share with our listeners. There's more suspense, more dramatic torque in one page of Hawthorne's heart-racked ruminations on the Christian conscience than in all Demi Moore's woodland gallops and horizontal barn dancing. Thou hast to be kidding.
I'll just read the opening of this piece, because people bring this up, and it's not meant that cruelly, but it's a reflection on the rise of a star. What is the point of Demi Moore? It's not that I don't get her. I simply can't see what's there for the getting. I suspect that people revere the sheer, steely professionalism that has propelled her into the first rank of fame. They react to her strategic skills, in other words, rather than to any particular artistry. Like many veteran politicians, Demi Moore seems to have lost the fizz that made her ambition rise in the first place. The rasp of her voice used to remind me of Veronica Lake. Now I just want to chuck throat lozenges at the screen. These days she looks a little glum, proof that celebrity is no laughing matter, and the sighting of her nudity has become a regular national event like the launch of the space shuttle. If she completes a successful docking, so much the better. Moore has now taken it upon herself to assume one of the canonical American roles. She plays Hester Prynne in the new movie adaptation of The Scarlet Letter. The film is, in the words of the opening credits, freely adapted from the novel by Nathaniel Hawthorne, in the same way that methane is freely adapted from cows. And so I go on. I mean, it's worth having fun with, because I mean, this is a great American novel, and in a way, I mean, to take it on, try and make a mainstream Hollywood movie, you know, get the methane out of the cow, as it were, is asking for trouble in the first place, isn't it? I mean, why do people presume that great movies will make great novels anyway? I mean, I suspect more good movies will be made from. Why do they suspect the good novels will become good movies anyway? I mean, more good short stories probably have turned into great novels. I mean, Hawthorne, Henry James. I mean, how do you make novels out of these things? I like movies which are fresh and new from the beginning. Somebody sat down and dreamed them up.
Bring on the trash. We're talking tonight with New Yorker film critic Anthony Lane. Here's your chance. Has Anthony Lane made you choke on your popcorn, made you howl? About what? Which film? Which Wicked Barb? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with New Yorker film critic supreme Anthony Lane. He's out with a new book, Nobody's Perfect. It's a collection of almost a decade's worth of his film reviews, and reviews that range much more widely than films. What do you want from a movie reviewer? A summary, a judgment, a literary rump? We've got Anthony Lane here. Duke it out with the master at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. John's calling from Melrose, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I've got a question about how it's possible for a film critic to come to a film with a fresh mind and understand the movie when they're watching it like a person who isn't a film critic would do so.
So, for instance, how to take notes and see it fresh at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. For instance, a film I'm thinking of is The Royal
Tenenbaums.
Tenenbaums.
That,
yeah.
That movie, I thought, was pretty bad. And almost everyone I've talked to who's seen it has thought it was pretty bad. Really, it's hard to sit through.
So in your circle, that was a pretty bad movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I know a lot of people who loved it, so...
Yeah, the critics all liked it a lot. And I think that's because the critics see so many films, and they're so formulaic that they sort of get lost in the movies. And when something comes along that's fresh and different, they'll like it because it's not the usual thing.
Just because it's different, not because it's good. All right, Anthony Lane,
But if you thought it was fresh and different, then that seems to me a virtue of some sort, isn't it?
Yeah, I thought it was, okay, I'll grant you, I thought it was different, but I didn't think it was particularly good. But you probably, having seen so many formulaic plots that for us aren't formulaic because we're not seeing them every day.
I know
we get
what you
the
mean.
Point.
I mean,
Anthony Lane, are critics made of jade? Are they necessarily jaded? And does it divorce them from the rest of the movie-going world?
I certainly think one needs to be careful about overpraising as well as underpraising. I remember this happened with L.A. Confidential, which is a pretty good movie. It's a very smart thriller. It's well written. Mm-hmm. It makes sense. You know, it's pretty satisfying and actually, you know, big range of good characters. The Ed Pierce character, the Kevin Spacey character. You know, absolutely. And you know, it got very, very good reviews, and mine was one of them. But I remember a friend of mine saying to me about fortnight later. He said, "Anthony, it's good, but you know, it's not Chinatown." You know, and it may sometimes be, if the surrounding landscape is a bit flat, you know, then you take, you know, the really good, competent, fun movie to be a masterwork, which it may not be. It may just be, you know, exceptional of its kind, but it's not really the masterwork. And as he's right, it wasn't Chinatown. I don't know if it'll last like Chinatown. I still think LA Confidential holds up pretty well, as does something like The Thomas Crown Affair, the remake, which I thought was just this smart, funny, grown-up thriller. I mean, it wasn't a particularly serious movie, but it was nicely worked out, and I don't know enough people saw it, actually.
And the Royal Tenenbaums.
Well, I like Royal Tenenbaums, but I mean, I was, I thought it was fresh and different, he would say. But I mean, I do think it's a genuinely strange film. It looks like it's made from a book, but there isn't a book. I saw it, oddly enough, it's one of the few films I saw it again, because my review, as usually, is in several minds about it all. And I went back and saw it again. It became much sort of sadder and stranger work, and I liked it. I think his previous film, Rushmore, is probably more, Wes Anderson's previous film, Rushmore, is more accessible. I think a lot of people had fun with that.
Anthony Lane, stand by.
But I'll go and see anything with Bill Murray. Basically, is what I'm saying. Okay.
Here's for Bill Murray. A lot of callers and not much time. Diane is calling. Welcome, Diane. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I wanted to ask Anthony Lane about if you have any, if there are actors that have been in small parts, bit parts that are much better than the movies. So, example.
Oh yeah.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Who would you think?
Like Bea Richards in Beloved, if I have her name right, or. Yeah. Val Kilmer, I think, was in one of those awful movies about Doc Holliday, or he played Doc Holliday. And
that's right. I love bit parts. I've always loved bit parts, and I agree. And I sometimes think that if you banish me to the desert island, which I think would probably be the best thing for me somehow, the people I'd miss wouldn't necessarily be the huge stars. You know,
right.
I wouldn't miss. I have to say, I wouldn't miss Tom Cruise that much, and he certainly wouldn't miss me. But some of the lesser stuff, I feel like all the way back through all the classics, you know, if you watch the great movies of the 30s and 40s and 50s, you know, all those women like Eve Arden,
exactly.
and Kay Thompson,
right.
And Celeste Holm. I mean, when I watch Casablanca, you know, more and more I love Claude Rains in it.
Right.
You know? I think he's as crucial to the movie as Bogart is. And when you watch, and Bogart was very democratic. He seemed to surround himself, you know, through his own offices or not, with just smart minor characters. So you know, you get Sidney Greenstreet coming, you get Peter Lorre coming in, you know, it's and as I was saying yesterday, I was talking about Casablanca and lecturing yesterday, and I said what I really love isn't the love story. What I like is Peter Lorre getting up from the table with a Vichy officer at each shoulder and going, "May I first please cash my chips?" You know, I mean, that's what I want to see. And I you know, I love those things all over. And I quite agree. Small you know, small parts are, you know, sometimes the most memorable bits. They're the jewels that glint in the mud, you know.
Diane, thanks for your call. Anthony Lane, our time is short, only a minute, but you write about how the domination of adrenaline in Hollywood these days, as opposed to the still moments, the quiet moments, can those ever come back? Can a pendulum swing?
Yeah, they will come back, and the movies are quite bulimic. They gorge themselves and then they kind of vend it all. And I do think there are moments when the quietness comes back. And I refer particularly to the, I don't know if your listeners saw a movie called Big Night, which was a wonderful movie. And it ended off with a guy making an omelet, which really doesn't sound that exciting, does it? You know, we all make omelets, mostly make a complete hash of it. But it strangely became completely fascinating. And the movie had built up this, it was just a movie about, you know, running a restaurant, really. And by the end, why should that 10 minutes of five minutes of somebody making a perfect omelet be so gripping? But it was. The place was, you could
somehow
hear a pin drop,
we'd been taken to the place that it
absolutely.
Was.
And I think movies both are a refuge from life and as it were a kind of an intensifying of life. I go to them both to kind of soothe me and to sort of make my life far more exciting than it otherwise be the rest of the time. You know, it's rainy old England. Why do you think I came to America and wanted to watch movies?
You make our lives the richer every week. You're in The New Yorker, and we thank you for being there. And
thank you
for this new book. It's really a pleasure. Nobody's Perfect by New Yorker film critic Anthony Lane. Thank you so much for being with us on Point tonight.
My pleasure.
Coming up, Jack Beatty joins me to look back at the news of the week. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
I can confirm to you that I have received a letter from the Iraqi authorities conveying his decision to allow the return of the inspectors without conditions.
Let's reflect on what we saw yesterday with this letter from Iraq. We didn't see Iraq suddenly acknowledging the error of its ways of the past 12 years. We cannot just take a 1.25 page letter signed by the foreign minister as the end of this matter. We have seen this game before.
As the president told the United Nations, the first time we may be completely certain that a terrorist state has nuclear weapons is when, God forbid, they use one. If someone is waiting for a so-called smoking gun, it's certain that we will have waited too long.
If you want to keep the peace, you've got to have the authorization to use force. But it's not, this is a chance for Congress to indicate support. A chance for Congress to say we support the administration's ability to keep the peace. That's what this is all about.
Terrorism and support of terrorists is not confined to large cities and metropolitan areas of America. It lurks in small towns and rural areas as well. Today's arrests send an unambiguous message that we will track down terrorists wherever they hide.
Palestinian officials said huge explosions destroyed two buildings inside Arafat's compound, an intelligence building that had been damaged in an earlier Israeli attack, and a building under construction for the National Security Forces.
Could we have prevented 9/11?
I would say.
I mean, that's the criticism all over this town and all over the country and all over the world. Could it have been prevented?
I can't say guarantee that it could have been prevented. There could have been some things done that there's possible that they might have been able to uncover some of this plot if they had had the information on individuals and they had followed them and they had surveilled them. I mean, all of those are it.
I have put the election behind me. But as a private citizen, I want to do everything in my power to see that the people of the state of Florida have the right to vote.
And there's a week, Kofi Annan announcing that Iraq will welcome back weapons inspectors Colin Powell saying, we've seen this game before. Donald Rumsfeld saying, we can't wait for nuclear weapons to be ready to go. And President Bush saying, Congress, give us the authority to use force if we need it. 6 U.S. citizens of Yemeni ascent arrested in a small town near Buffalo. Violence back to Israel with suicide bombings and Yasser Arafat's headquarters going up in smoke. Congressional hearings looking back on pre-9/11 intelligence failures. And Janet Reno, blast from the past, conceding in Florida in elections once again as in 2000, marred by voting irregularities. Jack Beatty, history piling on this week with resolutions, Congress, UN, everybody in play.
Yes, and two historic documents end the week. One, a text of a resolution Bush wants the Congress to sign supporting his efforts in Iraq and allowing him to, as he put, check the threat posed by Iraq and restore international peace and security in the region. Senator Biden and others have asked, well, does that mean Syria, Lebanon, other places in the region? The Democrats are going to try to restrict that wording so that it's just on Iraq.
But telling and interesting that the administration did not come back and say, oh, no, no, we just mean Iraq.
It is, isn't it? And that may tie into the second document, which is this new national strategy directive, which basically might be called the end of history. According to the United States, we're not going to allow any other great power to emerge. And on the basis of our fears of what it might do, we're going to reserve the right to strike at it before it manifests any belligerence. This is quite a doctrine.
Officials saying today we won't tolerate the rise of an adversarial military power. I wonder what they're saying tonight in Beijing about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's
not necessarily adversarial, but it's such a statement that we are the great I am.
I know. And, you know, I don't mean to be provocative, but if you play it back historically, the Japanese in 1941 could well have said to themselves, you know, the Americans are being belligerent. They've embargoed our oil. Their fleet is a standing menace to us. Let's destroy it. I mean, wasn't that sort of acting out of fear against a national security threat?
It's a combination we're looking at right now, Jack, of history and policy and visceral response. I couldn't help note in the resolution that the White House sent to Congress is a very explicit reference to the assassination attempt on President Bush's father. You know, you can see them in the tracksuits at Camp David saying, by God, enough is enough.
Yeah, you know, that is something. He mentioned that in the U.N. speech as well.
Well, and fair enough, an attack on a head of state is a very big deal.
It is a very big deal. And at the time, President Clinton, as I remember, rained down cruise missiles and whatnot on Baghdad. So perhaps there is this personal dimension to this. You know, the Bush administration, as we've said earlier, could have a tremendous success here if Saddam is serious about taking these inspectors back, and if the inspectors go back with a mandate that will satisfy us and we'll get the job done.
Maybe. But it doesn't seem to be at the top of their dance card. There's a lot being projected out to the world. I have a feeling as though we're now waiting for the echo from the world to come back. There will be an answer to all this, positive or negative. I don't know.
I think it's bound to be to this new defense doctrine. People are going to see it as sort of America, you know, American unilateralism enshrined in a doctrine. And Rome wasn't brought down by rival powers, but by the barbarians. And, you know, there are still those barbarians out there, those terrorists. And you could argue that stuff we do, you know, to ward off future threats can produce future terrorists, future barbarians. It's scary.
And yet, in an era of nuclear weapons, who wants an adversarial military power?
Well, I suppose that's right. The question is, as Arthur Schlesinger pointed out this week, we don't have certainty about these matters. And he said, and he's, of course, the presidential historian and former Kennedy advisor, that such a doctrine is possibly illegal and certainly immoral.
And there it is. Jack, have a great and thoughtful weekend.
You too, Tom.
We say goodbye tonight to On Point producer extraordinaire, the indomitable Micheline Boudreau. Mish has been with us from the first nanoseconds of On Point's life. She's carried us with strength and grace through terror and war and every manner of collapse in laughter, last-minute chaos here. She seemed immune to madness, but she is not, it turns out, immune to love and marriage and running off with a man. So here's to the bride and her new life in lucky Philadelphia. We will miss you, Micheline Boudreau. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.